TFM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Saddle Up, our dedicated Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I had a feeling that you were a bit hungry, but don't worry, I've brought you some waffles.
Well, all I know, Chris, is they're going to be gone in 60 seconds because I am hungry today, and I'm so glad you brought waffles because I love waffles. I didn't know if you knew that, but I'm a huge fan of waffles. In fact, some friends of ours, every 4th of July, have a waffle breakfast. They just invite a bunch of people over, and it's always fantastic. So, you know, watching this episode again, I was reminded, I mean, Pike apparently is just an excellent cook all around. I mean, he had like a great quiche there. He had a waffle. He had bacon. I mean, like, oh, he knows how to treat his crew.
He really does.
Pike might be the captain I want to be serving under most because he makes you food.
Exactly. Or at least served by.
No, I mean, yeah. But I mean, it seems like he does the cooking. So, I mean, man wears the pants on, you know, the bridge and in the kitchen. So
he sure does. All right. Well, you dig into those waffles and let me get you some bacon and we'll get going in this discussion.
Chris, do not make me stop this starship. Don't make me stop this starship.
Oh, man. There's a lot of great stuff at the beginning.
It really is.
And the end of this. And Spock with an apron, do the dishes. I love the reaction.
Mm-hmm. I love
Ethan
that.
Had. All right. Let's get moving here on our discussion of the 9th episode of Strange New Worlds Season 1. This is All Those Who Wander, and here is a quick rundown of the story. While on their way to Deep Space Station K-7 to deliver power cells, the crew of the Enterprise respond to a distress call from the USS Peregrine and find themselves in a fight for their lives against ferocious Baby Gorn. A derelict starship on an icy class L planet is pretty damn creepy, as Sam Kirk put it, and he was right. But that's just the beginning as the situation takes an alien turn and creatures start popping out of chests. In the end, they avoid becoming Lizard Chow. Thanks for that one as well, Sam. But the victory comes at a high price, as they must say goodbye to Chief Engineer Hemmer. So, Matthew, let's just start off with the elephant or the reptile in the room, the Gorn. Kind of cute little ones, kind of like gremlins, kind of like aliens. What do you think about this whole reimagining of the Gorn that we've been dancing around all season and now we've actually seen them?
Yeah. It's very, very interesting, Chris. I love the pun that you put on our outline, that they were going to be wild, and
well, they are wild.
Actually went,
yeah.
They went hog wild with these, this reimagining of the Gorn. And, you know, I think everybody can see that the writer of this episode was clearly influenced by the Aliens franchise and, of course, the Predator franchise. Both very popular films. In fact, we've covered them on the 602 Club. And so, and, you know, I mean, they're not even subtle about it. They are in many ways born the same way by breaking out of your stomach or parts of your body, you know. So I also think of the wonderful parody they do on Spaceballs at the diner.
Yeah,
that's actually my favorite. So you know, you and I actually talked behind the scenes on the other side of Pike's cabin. And the first time watching this, I was a little bit, how does this all fit and everything? But in all honesty, this very much seems to be jumping off from what we saw in Enterprise in the Mirror Universe episodes with the Gorn there.
Yeah.
And taking that as a reference. Because, you know, I mean, in the original series, like many things that we saw in the original series, I mean, Klingons look different in the motion picture because of makeup budget, right? It's all budgetary in that. So the idea that the Gorn are this lethal, this deadly, you know, that they basically reproduce by spitting on people like they're some sort of Dilophosaurus from Jurassic Park almost. I think it's an interesting reinvention, and it's not really reinvention because we just don't really know anything about them anyway. So
yeah.
It's difficult to look at the Gorn and TOS and then this, and it feels like whiplash, but in many ways it just kind of makes sense that you know, it would be different. And I, you know, looking side by side at the headshots of the one we got in Enterprise and the babies we get here, it's actually very similar.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I think it works for the most part. And I'm interested to see where they continue to go with this, because it does make for, I think, as Spock would say, like a fascinating look at this species. But yeah, I mean, I did not expect them to go all alien predator on us.
No, I did not really expect that either. The fact that they would take their cue from the Gorn that we saw on Enterprise doesn't surprise me, but to go to this extreme was not what I was expecting. Yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot as well, because I do like for the Star Trek universe to fit together so that it feels linear, so it feels like it all is a real world and it makes sense. Now, the Gorn, we didn't know much about them. We've seen the one. It just happens to be a very famous alien in one episode that is famous because the costume design was so brilliantly cheesy. I guess you could describe it that way. And it had to be at that time. I mean, what were you going to do in the 60s to create a reptilian humanoid? And to reimagine them as something that feels like a real creature, a real being of some kind, today with the technology that we have, is fine. And in fact, I believe that the babies that we see in here are animatronic and not CGI, which I think is a nice touch. And I like the fact that more people are starting to go back to that type of thing instead of everything being completely CGI. That's one of the things I liked about the J.J. Abrams Star Wars movies, is that they did try to use real things, real settings, real objects a bit more. But I've spent the time since watching this episode the first time last week thinking about the Gorn and how I feel about the reimagining and how it fits into Star Trek. And I think what I finally have settled on is that it doesn't make sense to frame the Gorn in a way that is tied completely to Arena and what we saw in Arena, because that was one episode more than 50 years ago, and we need to evolve the creative. But there are a few things about it that don't quite fit together for me. One is, La'an tells people here that, you know, we really have no chance against even one Gorn. And she's talking not about herself, but all of them. And yet Kirk fought this one Gorn by himself. So that part doesn't quite fit together, but I can let that go. The other thing is that we've seen their spaceships earlier in this season. And this is not specific to the Gorn. This is something that always feels a bit odd to me in science fiction in general. When you have aliens that are very much like creatures, animals, they're wild. They're going to be wild here. And yet they also become so technologically advanced, and they build starships and they do all the same things that humans or Vulcans or Klingons do. but it's hard to imagine how they got there from what we see of them. This is a reason on Discovery, I don't like the Ba'ul, who are the predator species on Saru's planet that hold down the Kelpians, because the way they're portrayed is they're like black oil creatures that pop up. And it's hard to imagine them also evolving the super advanced technology. So that aspect of it to me is a little bit of a disconnect. And I almost feel like if the writers, if they didn't want to tell an alien story, predator story, they might not make the Gorn quite as over the top, wild, ferocious creatures as they do. So those are my thoughts on it. I guess ultimately, giving this show room to explore the Gorn in the way that other shows have explored species that we didn't know very well until they came around is a good thing. We're just going to have to suspend our, not imagination, we're going to have to reshape our headcanon a little bit, I guess, to make it all fit together.
I really like that, Chris, because I think I'm on the same wavelength as you in the sense that there are parts of this that I kind of am bothered by, and very much the same way you are. Just, it just seems like, try to work it in a little bit better, mm-hmm. you know, like, yeah, okay. So we've got this character, and we've seen them before in TOS. We know that Kirk bests a Gorn. So to say that you don't have a chance against one, that seems a little bit over the top. Now, coming from La'an, who is a child tortured by the Gorn, basically, it makes a little bit more sense. And we don't really know anything about the Gorn, and therefore, that coming from her, I think, because all of our information about the Gorn comes from her, I don't necessarily know if she's always the most reliable narrator.
Yeah, that's very
for that.
True.
And so I think that actually helps in this, is that, you know, a lot of what she's saying is based off the experience of somebody who is a young girl. And when we're young, things always feel worse and bigger than they may actually be. And so I think that helps in that this situation. But I do. I'm there with you. It's like, and I think you're 100% right in that there are some times where I do feel like sometimes the writers of the new Trek don't always take into account and work as hard as they could to make things a little bit more cohesive. And that is frustrating to me, obviously, very much so, because I like things to feel like that as well. I mean, you know, it's been a hallmark of Star Trek. But the more thought I put into this, the more that I felt like this is pretty good, you know, on a scale of things that they've done, this is pretty good. And I think I'm interested enough now to be able to wonder where they will take it in the future.
Yeah. I think that, as a standalone piece of creative work, it's done quite well. It's shot well. The visuals are good. It's suspenseful. If you didn't know anything about the Gorn at all going in, then these creatures work very well for the story. So it's just that little bit of having to connect dots that they didn't quite connect and make it work for yourself. I will say one last thing about the Gorn. And them being so ferociously wild, and yet having built this technology. It is true that we're only seeing baby Gorn here, so we don't know, you know, maybe they're all like the 2-year-old toddlers running through the mall, breaking everything, and they grow up to be very dignified lizards and very calm and pensive and innovative. We don't know, but from what we saw here, it was definitely a horror movie take on creatures rather than the usual Star Trek the aliens from the Chase seeded all the planets and everybody kind of evolved in a similar manner, yeah, kind of thing. Speaking of horror, I did want to get your thoughts on Star Trek as a platform for telling horror stories in general. We don't get that many of them, but from time to time, there is an attempt to tell a scary story. In the past, it hasn't necessarily been graphic like this. I think about DS9 and Impak Nor. It's a great haunted house. It's scary in a sense, if you imagine yourself being there, but it's not this type of horror story. Do you think Star Trek works well for telling horror?
I do. I think that's, you know, it's one of the hallmarks of all of Star Trek is that you utilize these different genres to tell different types of stories. And I think that this one does a great job of tapping into a lot of the fears that a lot of our characters are going through. And so it works well with the story that we're trying to tell for somebody like Hemmer or Uhura, even La'an, and Spock, of course, you know. And so what I like is that by utilizing this scary story, we're tapping into the story that we're trying to tell about these different characters. And I think that actually really works here for this. And so as long as the genre that you're using helps exemplify the character-driven story you're trying to tell, I think that's a win.
Yeah, yeah. It worked well for the characters, I think, for sure. And it pushed... What I noticed, it stood out to me in the previously on segment at the beginning, is how many threads they were pulling for the characters, for the stories that we've seen in just 8 episodes. And then throughout here, they also tied into what happened to Mbenga, actually, with his daughter, where he gets frustrated and he says, "Stop harassing my daughter." And then he realizes, you know, catches himself right away. But I thought that was also a nice way of just acknowledging that something happened to the character and that he is struggling with that. When we talked about that episode, I mentioned that I would like to see him have to struggle a bit with what has taken place rather than having that ending where his daughter just magically comes back in a few minutes. And here, at least we get a little bit of acknowledgement.
No, that's great. And it's an excellent moment for that character specifically. And I was really glad that they brought that back. And I think what it does is it gives us a clear picture is this character is not okay.
Right.
And I think that's a good thing for us to understand about this character. This character is not okay after his daughter is gone. It's been a really tough transition for him. And I think that's really smart writing because you're having a man who is going to have to mourn the loss of ever really having his daughter. She's been gone for so long, and now he'll never really have her as a daughter again. So,
while we're talking about characters and their storyline progressing, let's jump to what we have at the end of the outline, which is La'an going off to look for the parents of this girl, and Pike is giving her space and her time to go do it and telling her come back, however long it takes, come back. I'm curious to see how they handle this aspect of her going off and doing something. And what I thought about when that scene took place is I hope that the show doesn't start sliding into serialization too much, because I've really been enjoying the standalone episode format with the very light continuity running through it. And if we have a character who's going to be going off and doing something else that sounds like it could be a mission that needs to be told over the course of several episodes or more, I don't want to lose the episodic nature of the show that we've been getting so far, because I think we really need to keep this format in at least one show in the modern Star Trek franchise.
It's interesting because I've been thinking about that too, and I don't know if I, you know, even watching the episode a second time, see that they would go and basically follow La'an as like a side story every few episodes. Because I feel like this is a better way to be able to let you tell that story. And then basically you could come back to that where the Enterprise goes on a mission or whatever, and then they end up running into La'an or, you know, something like that, right? I think there's ways to do this without doing that, which I think would be a detriment to the series, because one of the great parts of the series is exactly what you said. There's a loose continuity, but it feels more like Enterprise or Deep Space Nine, where it's not about really, really heavy serialization that you just kind of get bogged down in.
Yeah. Now, some listeners might tell us, hey, DS9, that's not heavy serialization. But the really strong serialization in DS9 comes later in the series. And even when they're doing that, because they had 26 episodes to work with, we still get standalone episodes scattered amongst that. So, yeah, it's not to the same extent of modern TV, for sure.
Well, and I mean, yeah, gosh, the biggest serialization really was that, I think, the final, 10 episodes, you know?
Yeah, and maybe like the first part of season 6, you know?
Yeah, there, and those type of places there, they were definitely some more heavy, but, you know,
yeah,
for a majority of the seasons, it is more loose continuity that we're building on and using the stories and seeing what happens.
So let's talk about the biggest character moment in this episode. One that was a huge missed opportunity, I have to say. Sam Kirk, perfect opportunity for him to almost die, and he didn't. What happened?
Sam Kirk not injured in this episode. We just have the new lieutenant die instead.
Oh my gosh.
And so,
okay.
Yeah.
You just knew that when there's a Lieutenant Duke, where'd he come from? You knew he wasn't coming back from this mission, right?
Yes. And it was actually kind of frustrating because it was like, okay, you guys have really telegraphed yourselves badly here. And it was, I think it was also even more frustrating that not only did Lieutenant Duke die, but the other cadet who was with Uhura died. And I was just like, okay, what's the point of like, I don't know. It just felt a little bit silly. And I get, you know, you're going to have Hemmer die, and that's going to be your real big emotional pull for the episode. Yeah. But those two just kind of felt like, okay.
Yeah,
I saw that coming.
Well, I think Lieutenant Duke was there not so much to get killed by the Gorn, but just so the writers could remind Harry Kim one more time that he never got promoted to lieutenant, because you know Harry's watching this going, man, look at that. I was on the ship for 7 years and Janeway never promoted me like this.
That is a real suck it Harry Kim moment right there.
It was. And that huge smile, huge grin from Pike.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
He's just like, yeah, I'm one up in Janeway. So.
Exactly. And he's saying, I can make you a really good cup of coffee, Catherine.
That's right. Yeah.
And some waffles to go with it. All right. Speaking of telegraphing things, though, for some reason, in the cold opening and the previously on, when they showed Hemmer and Uhura, and they showed that bit of dialogue with Hemmer explaining, you know, that his mission in life is to fix things that are broken. And I'm thinking back to that scene in the actual episode where it happened. And I had this feeling like they're going to kill Himmer. Himmer's going to be off the show. And then sure enough, that's where it went. And you and I were talking, I think we were talking before we recorded Warp 5 last time, maybe. And you said, I won't say anything about the episode because often I haven't watched it yet. And I told you, it's okay, I watched it last night. And you asked me what I thought about it. And I said, I didn't really like it so much. And the reason that that was my reaction on first viewing is that they killed Himmer primarily. And he's a character that I've been wanting to know more about. I've been disappointed that he was missing from so many episodes mm-hmm. this season. And then they make him a central part of the episode before this one.
Right.
And now he's gone. And I've had some thoughts about it since then and what it means for the story. But in the moment, I was really disappointed that he was leaving the show. How did you feel about this rather unexpected turn of events?
Mm-hmm. I was surprised, like you were. I did not expect them to kill Himmer. And I like you, found him to be a really interesting character and wanted to know more about him. You know, the Aenar from Andoria are not a species we know a ton about, and so would have loved to have explored more of that. And yet, when it came to the story of, you know, him fulfilling his purpose and to fix broken things and the idea of, like, self-sacrifice, you know, I think this is something that Spock will catalog into the back of his mind. And obviously, you know, one of the things you mentioned, even I think before we started recording, was that it felt very Wrath of Khan in some ways, yeah, like making yeah. that self-sacrificial moment so everybody else can live. And I thought it was beautiful in the way it's played. You know, I think, you know, Uhura and Himmer have been this really great relationship. And I thought it was beautiful because, you know, really, he becomes the character who dies, which is going to be the linchpin for Uhura staying in Starfleet, for Uhura putting down roots, for Uhura being willing to love people and have people love her, which opens up the ability for somebody to hurt them again. You know, I mean, she comes from a family where parents have died, and that leaves a mark on you, and she has been afraid to really feel for anyone because, or have anybody reciprocate that without her leaving them first, because then it's never unexpected, and then you can never truly get hurt that way. And so, and of course, you know, he tells her that at the end he wants her to open yourself, make a home for yourself amongst others, and you will find joy more often than sadness. And, you know, I think it's very true. And just what he does for her is really beautiful. But I also think it's a message that it's more universal than just these two. It's like the idea that we need each other, and that we're better off together than apart. And figuring out what it is that brings us together instead of separates us is a really nice theme. So I really liked the thematic elements here, and it, you know, it's something to which they had kind of written in, to the series so far. And I also really liked, I did read, that this was specific. This was not something they just willy nilly did. No, the plan mm-hmm. was, and Bruce knew coming in that was going to be the arc for his character. So this was not a surprise, or that, you know. So to me, I was like, okay, I appreciate they had a plan. They stuck with it. The actor then had that foreknowledge to, I think, really be able to make the most of every scene he was in, especially with Uhura. And to me, it ended up working. Am I sad that the character's gone? Yes, I think I really am, because I would have loved, I liked this character. I wanted more of them. But at the same time, I think this death does a lot for a lot of our other characters in the show.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really nice, it's a really nice jumping off point now for all of these different characters.
Yeah. When you look at it in that way, it makes sense. And I think it works well. We've chatted about it a bit since the first viewing of it. And so I've had time to think about that a bit more as well. And when you talked about it in this framing, as you did right now with relation to Uhura, that helped me a lot. And then knowing that it was planned from the beginning that this character would only be in the first season and would have a fairly specific role in the overall story, which is tied directly to Uhura's journey as a cadet on the Enterprise, then it definitely makes more sense from a writing mm-hmm. standpoint. I think that the fact that he was presented as being the chief engineer and yet he was not in a lot of episodes and now he's gone at the end of the first season is one reason why a lot of people probably feel like, why, what happened? Because yeah. we're not used to that in Star Trek. We're accustomed to our main crew, the people who are in the key mm-hmm. roles, stick around, usually for the full run of the series. And we're not used to them being used in a way that's specific to supporting one other character, I guess is mm-hmm. how I might look at it. But yeah, in this case, it does make sense. And if you're going to do that for Uhura, of course, you need a character that no one's familiar with because you can't kill number one. You can't kill Spock off to support Uhura. You certainly right. can't kill Sam Kirk because apparently nothing can kill Sam Kirk, at least not.
It's true. He is indestructible.
Not until later.
Indestructible, Chris.
On the timeline, anyway, he is.
Well, that's true. That's true. So he will meet his maker. It's just not here. So.
Just not here, right. So in this sense, the sacrifice of the character works. The other thing that you mentioned, which I had told you a little bit about, and I jotted some notes down on the outline, is the parallel with the Wrath of Khan. And it's something that I didn't pay attention to all that much on first viewing, but on the second viewing and really listening to what Hemmer is saying and what Pike and the others are saying to him as well. And he's explaining why he has to make the sacrifice and he's going to save everyone else, and he has fixed what was broken. And this is the next step that he needs to take. It all felt very much like the ending of the Wrath of Khan, and even in words. And Spock quietly to himself says, a logical conclusion. And I felt like yep. if we talk about adding texture to Star Trek and to our headcanon and making later stories richer, when you watch The Wrath of Khan now and you see Spock sacrifice himself to save the ship, you can imagine that he's remembering what Hemmer did to save everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so that is Absolutely. Now in his head. And
that's his headcanon.
That's his headcanon, exactly. And so for that reason also, I think that while this was an unexpected turn on the first viewing, and it's disappointing to see the character go, in the bigger picture, I think that in his short time on the show, he served a good purpose in helping other characters and I don't even want to say filling in gaps, because it's less about specific facts, for example, that he's mm-hmm. filling in, but it's more like
right.
influence on characters that we know that he's mm-hmm. filling in that will make later stories a little bit richer.
Well, he and his story is adding texture to those character stories, like you said, that we already know, and filling in the motivations that we didn't realize were there, but we have seen the implications of in the future, which I think is really cool. And I think one of the things that I ended up having a question about, you know, we see Spock let out his emotions as if he's the Hulk Spock. And, you know, that's my secret chapel. I'm always angry. And by doing so, he realizes that he can't just put a lid back on the Tupperware. And that's dangerous, right? And I'm wondering, is this how we get shouty Spock? Because his emotions are more to the surface. Like, he's let them out and he can't necessarily get them back in.
Maybe so. He's always nervous that something is going to happen. He's always nervous there could be a baby Gorn around. So he's always yelling, check the circuit!
Exactly, exactly.
Check it for baby Gorn.
And that's really a joke, because what I actually think this is going to tie into is the story that we've been telling with learning more about Vulcans and, of course, Cybok and all of that. And I think that's where this is really going to play in, is where Spock and his he is actually going to have to face a choice, I believe, in the future. Do I follow Cybok, or do I continue to be the person that I have been all of these years, which is somebody who follows more of the Vulcan philosophy? And so I think that's actually where we're headed. So, but shoddy Spock is a fun idea.
Yeah, no, that's a great observation about how this might tie into the Cybok story, because I was not expecting that we're going to get a long, lengthy Discovery style Cybok story, but certainly he's going to be back. You don't just introduce him by name and show the back of his head and then have him never come back around, right? So definitely in, well, possibly next, the final episode of the season could happen. If not, I think early in season two, anyway, we'll probably have something like what you're describing. The other thing I think that this scene with Spock's rage and Chapel coming to console him, talking about adding texture, I think that if you go back to the original series now, and if you remember his reaction when she brings him soup and he storms into his quarters, smashes the display, reading that now, you can think about what happened in this episode and the fact that Chapel saw it, and then she went to him and calmed him down. And so that brings them closer together, and she's aware that he has this thing that might happen sometimes. And so when you see it happen in the original series, you can imagine that what she's thinking is quite different than what we've always imagined in the past, where it's like, oh my goodness, this is always under control Vulcan is flipping out suddenly. But no, now Chapel knows, oh, you know, he does have this locked away inside. So that adds a bit more texture to the readings of episodes we've been watching for 50 years.
Well, and it also adds, I think, you know, a lot of texture. Just, I mean, just Bush's face in that moment where they're face to face, it says everything, which is that I'm in love with you and I want to do everything I can to help you. And, you know, it's just, it's so heartbreaking. And she's so good, and they're both so good in that role. And I mean, you can even see in Spock's face as he turns, which is that, oh crap, kind of moment almost, I think, of like, I could have taken this to another level if I wasn't in control at all, right? And I think that the temptation is there for him, because there's something about their relationship. I think in many ways, I think she's actually really good for him. I think it's because she respects his human side and understands it. and at the same time encourages him in his Vulcanness, right? But also to be able to find more of a cohesion between the two. And I almost wonder, and I think this would be fascinating, you know, book series, I think, honestly, is to explore Sarek. Why did Sarek marry human women?
Yeah.
Is it the same reason? Is that it? Was it that he maybe is more of a Vulcan, like in the vein of T'Pol, who his emotions were actually a little closer to the surface, and by marrying a human woman, he was actually able to become more whole as a Vulcan because of that? To me, that's just something that I think would be fascinating to understand, because, you know, here with Spock and his relationship with Chapel, there's so much there, and there's so much there then for the family, I think, which would be really interesting to kind of understand more of. So,
yeah. Well, you can imagine that if the Vulcans are going to send someone to Earth to be the ambassador, if there is a Vulcan who might be a little bit more in touch with emotions, mm-hmm. that's a person who would be ideal for the role. And then once he's on Earth, as he acclimates to the local culture and becomes part of that,
right,
then the fact that he would marry a human woman is not surprising at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that could be an interesting backstory. I don't know if we'll
you
get any of
that. You got the touch. Anyway.
I don't know if we'll get any of that in the series or not, but maybe. It's certainly possible.
Well, and it just seems like, you know, when you're thinking about stories that you probably would never tell in these series
yeah.
that we see on television, but great questions, it's like, let a novelist go at that.
Yeah.
You know, let one of the great Trek novelists really dive into that, because why not?
Yeah.
Because it can't hurt anything you're going to do in the series, and it only adds layers, and like the word of this episode is texture. I think it only adds that texture to these stories that we're watching, so.
Yeah, well, they've been doing that with Discovery and Picard, so it seems natural that yep. they might do that yep. with this series as well. I'd also like to see a mm-hmm. novel that explains who in Starfleet security thought that 246810 was a secure command code on a starship. It's only slightly better than 0000 destruct zero
than
or
1234455.
Exactly.
That's my luggage combination.
Also about Spock. Did you notice that Sam Kirk was channeling Bones here? When he went off on Spock,
he definitely
I just heard
was.
Him go, haven't you got any goddamn feelings about that?
Yep, I heard it. I thought it was absolutely, you know, it was great. Like, and that is interesting because, you know, you think about that relationship and the fact that Sam is a little bit more like Bones.
Yeah.
And then if Kirk is, you know, Kirk. Jim is Jim. It kind of makes sense as to how they would get along as brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I also kind of love the idea that Sam is a little more hot-headed, you know, and those type of things. So, yeah, I agree with you. That was actually really nice to see. So, yeah, this episode was just jam-packed full of stuff, which I really loved, and, you know, in all honesty, I come to the end of this episode and I think to myself, man, I almost wish that this wasn't the penultimate episode of season one, because I really want more stories.
Yeah, same here. Well, that sounds like the beginning of some final thoughts, Matthew.
I guess I was channeling my inner, you know, captain's log at that point, but they have really, I think, set the stage for some interesting places that this can go, you know, with who replaces La'an, who replaces the chief engineer position, which it could be Scotty, because I don't think we ever really have the chief engineer mentioned in The Cage.
Right, right.
Other than maybe calling them the chief engineer. It's been a long time since I've watched The Cage.
Yeah, so. That's something I meant to talk about when we talked about him or leaving, is that by clearing out this position, it does give them the opportunity in season two to bring Scotty aboard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of places that you can go. Oh, the places you will go. And
all those who wander to those places.
All those who wander.
Where you can go
are not
now.
Always lost. Yeah. So, but the thematic elements in this were really beautiful. I really enjoyed how we tie into so many of these characters' arcs throughout the season. And I would say to me, other than the fact that this ship is apparently half the size of the Enterprise, but still looks basically the same size.
It's made out of the same parts, Matthew.
Yeah, I know, which is weird. I'll give this 4.5 out of 5 slightly smaller ships.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I think that the Sombre class is made out of all the bend parts that Starfleet, you know, they made nacelles, they made saucers, mm-hmm. they didn't turn out mm-hmm. quite right, so they can't use them in the Constitution class, so they just stick them together to make this slightly less powerful, slightly less reliable ship.
It's real fast, though, you know. Okay, can I just say that is one of the things in the episode that I actually knock the half star off of, is that you didn't just create a totally different ship.
Yeah.
Especially one from the TOS era that fans would have loved to have seen, like the Archer class or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Just that you basically have a smaller Constitution class vessel felt, I don't want to say lazy, it just didn't feel like the best choice you could have made. So I would have loved to have seen them have a different Starfleet vessel.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it is to put the characters in an environment that feels very much like the Enterprise itself. That could be a reason. I'm just imagining creatively why you would do it. Because my thought also was, these aren't models. You can make any ship you want. So why make one that looks basically like the Enterprise, mm-hmm. but it's a different class. And
because Chris, you can literally just scale it down in Photoshop. And
maybe that's the reason. Because, yeah, it is true. You probably do save some money on visual effects work here by not having recreate a ship. But yeah, anyway, that's fine. Speaking of the ship, the name of the episode is All Those Who Wander. The name of the ship is the Peregrine. Peregrine is a wanderer or a traveler, is the archaic meaning of the word. And the modern word means to have a tendency to wander around, but historically the word meant an alien or a traveler or someone from a foreign country. And I thought that worked on many levels for this story, not only for the people that the Peregrine picked up who were infected with the Gorn eggs, but also about our characters being on a journey. We see that with Himmer, with Uhura, with La'an now as well. So many levels, I think that the name works well. And also, another missed opportunity, however, Peregrine is also the name of an Australian indie rock band. And so they could have had a guest appearance by a younger Adam from The Way to Eden playing his guitar. See, that's the kind of TOS tie-in I'm here for. But anyway, we did get the K7 reference tie in here.
Yes, that was nice. Yeah. I was actually hoping we were going to get CK7. So,
yeah, that would have been awesome. Maybe we will at some point. All right. Well, yeah, my overall thoughts in closing here on the episode is that my reaction to it on second viewing was quite different than first viewing. And I think it's because it was an episode where on the surface, it is this horror story, and it's easy to get caught up in what's going on with the baby Gorn and the danger and the chase and all, and not pay as much attention to the character interactions and how things like him or helping Uhura, for example, play into the story. And so in the second viewing, when I'm paying more attention to that and what the writers are doing with the characters, instead of worrying about if baby lizards are going to pop out of my chest, the episode worked a lot better for me. So it is one of those that I think you need to let it percolate a little bit and then watch it again, and it reads better. So I'm going to give this one 7 sides of bacon.
That's a good rating right there.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on All Those Who Wonder. There are many ways for you to share those. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're already a member, you know how it works. But if not, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group, so please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post for this episode on the timeline, and you can leave your thoughts there in the comments. Share them with fellow listeners and Matthew and me. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. Just go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose Saddle Up, and that'll come to Matthew and me by Pony Express. And in social media, on Instagram, Twitter, everywhere, our username is TrekFM. And also, if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not piling the kids into the station wagon, where can people find you?
Well, I love doing that. It's so much fun. But when I'm not traveling around old school 70s style, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. So that's Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero, any of those type of places you'll find me. Of course, here on the network, we've got an entire side of the network not devoted to Star Trek, but all the other fandoms we love, and it's called the 602 Club, and I love doing that show, and so I hope you'll check that out. Some great bonus shows in that feed as well for you. So we've got a ton packed into one feed for you. Do literary treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Chris, you and I talk about Enterprise on Warp 5. We've got The Orb, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, of course, and then The Artificial Tango about Star Trek Picard, and then you'll find me over in the Nerd Party Network. I've got a completed show with Drea Kaufman that we did called Owl Post. It's all about Harry Potter, one chapter at a time. And then Aggressive Negotiations with the great John Mills, where we talk about Star Wars. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out why Spock is in an apron in the hallway, where can people find you?
Oh, he's wearing that apron because he was helping me wash and wax my station wagon. I've got the
Fantastic. Cool,
it's pea green. It's got that really thick wood grain running down both sides. It's fantastic. But when we're not doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing the shows with you that you mentioned. And also Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. There's Interphase, and you can find me in all sorts of episodes of many shows on the network in the back catalog. So check that out if you're interested in my other thoughts on Star Trek. And if you'd like to chat in social media, you can find me under the username C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere in social media, but Twitter is where I'm most active, and I'd love to hear from you there. And if you would like to help us keep this show and all the shows we mentioned, everything we're doing in the network going, we could definitely use your help. If you'd like to find out how to get involved, how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can become an associate producer, get involved in other ways, and we would love to have your support. And I want to send a huge thank you to everyone who is supporting us right now. We would not be here without you, so thank you very, very, very much. Well, Matthew, it's hard to believe, but we've only got one episode to go. And speaking of that, though, we should let people know that because of our activities coming up, after that final episode of Strange New Worlds, we're going to be delayed a few days in covering that and getting it out to everyone. So please be patient, and we'll have our coverage of the finale out to you just a few days later than usual.
Well, Chris, I am so excited that we are going to be doing that, and I'm sure it will be a monster episode. So all I've got to say is saddle up and lock and load.